morning. Really? Let's try that again. Good morning. There we go. Can you guys hear me all right? So I want to ask a couple questions to start with. And I'd like everyone to close their eyes for a moment. Just indulge me in this. And when I ask the questions, I'd like you to raise your hand in response. So I'll close my eyes too. Don't worry, we'll all be together in this. So just close your eyes. And if you have a Kindle, raise your hand. If you have an iPad, raise your hand. Put your hands down. If you have a Nook, raise your hand. Put your hands down. If you have an iPhone, raise your hand. Put your hands down. All right, let's try this again. Let's have you clap. If you have a Kindle, clap your hand. Much better. If you have an iPad, clap your hand. If you have a Nook, clap. If you have an iPhone, clap. Kindle, iPad, Nook, iPhone, Kindle, iPad, Nook, iPhone, Kindle, iPad, Nook. So I've been asking this question at almost all of my talks over the last few years, and it's just amazing to see how bad the Nook is doing. Now, it's amazing to see just like how much of a dissemination, and it's kind of beautiful to hear that dissemination of these technologies to everyone now. And so when we think about the shape of our future book, we're, you know, I think the thing we need to keep in mind is that we're thinking about, and we are sort of like carrying this weight of the emotional response, of the romanticisms, of the mysticisms that we've created around the idea of a book. Some real, many imagined. And so today I want to tell a story. I want to tell a story sort of like a bedtime story, except we can call it a lunchtime story. And when we're done, we can go and eat lunch. It's a story inspired by Eames' Powers of 10 video, where we zoom out to get a broad perspective on things and then zoom back in. It's kind of like a telescope and a microscope and a movie projector all in one. It's a story also inspired by the travel writing of Antonio Tabucci in the book, Indian Nocturne. And also by the imaginings of the afterlife by Eagleman in the book Some. But before we get to the sort of ethereal, the myth, the story of today, I want to ground us with three points about thinking about content and the future book as I've found myself thinking about it in the last year working at a startup. So I've been working at a startup as a designer, focused on the future of content on the iPad, on the iPhone. And I've been thinking about the form of content for almost a year now, constantly. And more I see three things come up that as a designer I have to deal with, and also that as a designer I feel like a lot of other designers aren't aware of. And these things are going to become more important the more we progress into a totally digital space of reading. The first one, they're all related to data. The first one is to tame unfiltered data. What I mean by that is, how many of you every day sit down and read through your entire unfiltered Twitter stream? No, like there's like five of you who are insane. But it's an impossibility, right? It's just sort of, it's an interface built for a service that, you know, 3-4 years ago worked really well because you're only following 10, 15, 20, 30 people. And so this idea of unfiltered data kind of falling in front of the user is something that a lot of startups are trying to attack. And so you get companies like My Sixth Sense, or you get companies like Sumify, which do kind of really interesting jobs summarizing your Twitter stream. You get companies like Flipboard, which are also doing a wonderful job summarizing your Twitter stream. The second point, the second task that we've had to attack is to produce quiet data. And I love this. Tom over at Berg in London had this great blog post about a year ago about quiet technologies, about the quiet confidence of the Kindle versus the iPad. If you put them both on a table, the Kindle sort of blends in with the environment. It doesn't call attention to itself. And I think that the experience of using a Kindle, a hardware Kindle, if anyone has used them, I think that experience of using hardware Kindle, it speaks for itself in that you are actually able to engage with the text wholly. And what I mean by that is, like, I don't know about you guys, but I have a hard time using an iPad to read long texts because there's always mail or Angry Birds just one tap away. And so the idea of the creative technology or the quiet technology, I think, also applies to data. And as designers, we need to be aware of this sort of philosophy around what data we put in front of users. We need to make sure that it's quiet. And then the third point is to corral data, which is kind of encompassing all these points, that we need to tame the unfiltered streams, we need to produce quiet data, and we need to corral data. And the reason why I'm speaking so much about data is because we're kind of on the precipice of this massive collection of reading data. Every time you turn a page, every time you tap into an article, every time you highlight something, machines are now recording it, they're triangulating it, they're looking at it from 1,000 different angles, and that this data at some point is going to start to bubble up to the surface. And as designers, we almost have a moral obligation to understand where this data is coming from and why it's there, and to make sure that it's manifest properly and quietly and gets out of the way. Another thing I've noticed working at a startup for the last year, and I've worked freelance my whole life, and this is my first time actually working at a company and going so heads down for such a long time, is that you tend to lose perspective. Matt Might made a great illustration about what it means to get a PhD, and I think that that is totally apropos to sort of the experience you have working in a startup or working on the edge of a field like this, trying to think of what is the shape of the future book. So the illustration starts like this. This is a circle that represents the whole sum total of human knowledge. In elementary school, you gain this much knowledge. In high school, you gain this much. You go to college and you start to veer off in a certain direction. Maybe you go to grad school to further explore that direction. Then you read research papers and you start to push on the edge of knowledge as all of humanity knows it, and you push and you research, and then one day you pop through, you pop through the edge of all of human knowledge, you create a knowledge nipple, which is also known as a PhD, apparently. And then you live in this knowledge nipple. And I'll stop saying that, I'm sorry. And this is where kind of startups live too. And I think the thing we forget in startups is that we need to keep this entire perspective in our vision. And, you know, especially with the future of reading, because it's not just text, it's not just nice fonts and good lettering and blah, blah, blah. It is this holistic gathering of so many disparate components. You know, I spend, at my company, I spend every day speaking with back-end engineers, front-end engineers, curators. We talk to publishers. This is as a designer. And I think that all designers should be working in such a cross-platform, sort of cross-disciplinary way. Because the future interfaces for the future book need to understand and represent this holistically to do something genuine. And one of the ways I like to get this perspective, I like to say that great design is born from nourishing habits. And one of the habits I love to cultivate is this idea of traveling, of distancing yourself to gain this perspective. And in Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, Genghis Khan and Marco Polo are speaking to one another. And Marco has kind of traveled the world, and he's come back, or he's imagined to travel the world, and he's come back, and he's telling, you know, the great Khan about all these adventures. And the Khan asks him, well, why do you travel? You don't bring back riches. You don't bring back political knowledge. You bring back these sort of whimsical stories about the places you've been. And Marco responds, the more one was lost in unfamiliar quarters of distant cities, the more one understood the other cities he had crossed to arrive there. And I think that this is something we absolutely need to do. This traveling to distant cities, whether real or imagined, is so critical if we're working on these frontiers of knowledge, of interface design, of combining all of these disparate fields into one place to provide a wonderful, nourishing experience that lives up to that myth of the book that preceded what we're doing now. So I want to share a myth with you. Over the last few months, as I've sort of stuck my head deeper and deeper into the world of a startup, I found this strange image evolving in my head, and one hopes it isn't a brain tumor, but it's this very, very distinct image that kept growing and growing and growing. So what I did is I took that image out, connected with sort of the past of reading, where we're going, sort of a sense that although my head was so deep in the sand of sort of looking at iPhones and iPads, there was a sense of a greater sort of history weighing on top of the work we were doing. And I'd like to share that image, that exaggeration of the history of the book, this imagined history of the book, with you today. Thousands of years and thousands of miles outside the port city of Shanghai, and don't ask me why Shanghai, I don't control these things, in the strange, hot, cold deserts of the Gobi, and again, I don't know why the Gobi, known as the Endless Sea, deep in the heart of Mongolia, it was discovered. At first, nobody knew what it was. Of course, it was too large to be immediately understood. The precise dimensions, while at the time unknown, ended up being 5 kilometers long north-south, 2 kilometers wide east-west, with a depth of 0.5 kilometer into the sands of the desert. But it has been surmised that this object was actually much, much deeper and was raised by the shifting winds, and the earth had lifted it out of the desert floor. Nobody knows who exactly was the first person to stumble upon a piece of it, to become aware of it. But each village has their own theories and their own myths. For some, it was a child, others a woman. There are tales of wanderers with visions and conquerors with nightmares, drawn to the space where this object was. Regardless of who found it or how it was found is really not of concern today. All we care about is the now and how we got here and why we're here, into which we need to look. From the point of first discovery to understanding the enormity of the object took nearly 200 years. It was largely ignored at first, trickling in through little bits of mythology. For many generations, it simply loomed in the contradictions of that evolving mythology, a thing, a nothing, and everything, something worth investigating or ignoring, dismissed, considered. Still slowly, people found the edges. Mapping technology improved and information was shared, lines triangulated, expeditions sent out to measure, to look for other instances of this object. Once a general sense of the size was achieved, sand and earth began to be moved by these people. Thousands of workers worked in concert to displace the earth that was covering this thing. Entire generations devoted their lives to speculation around the object. Religious factions sprang up in devotion to the object. Finally, the earth around and down alongside this thing was fully removed, and the totality of the size of the object could be understood. From the crest of the Alishan Peninsula, on the other edges of the Gobi, it was visible. Stark, the contrast of its deep brown surface against the golden and light brown sand, something beautiful, something that demanded absolute consideration. But still, it was huge! It was massive, and it looked to be covered entirely by a seamless layer of animal skin. The scientists at the time worked out that there was a hinge along the western edge. And maybe, just maybe, if they could work out a system by which to apply force, they could move this thing about the hinge. Again, calculations, a generation. It had now been hundreds of years since the first discovery of this object. Its existence had embedded itself into the very fabric of these desert societies living near and around it. Stories of the object had spread as travelers moved along the Silk Road. Traders described the rough surface, took it home to their families, told their wives and children about its impossibilities. In this whimsical remembrances of the elderly, you found it. In the bedtime stories of children, in the pre-bedtime chatter of adults, songs were sung about it, to it, and for it. The great push to move about the hinge began. Consider the mere size of the object. How could this ever be moved? People said most doubted it could be opened, but still the scientists, primitive as their methodologies were, understood the simple mechanics of a simple machine to multiply force. They understood leverage and pulley systems. Certainly they thought, through mechanical advantage, this could be done. The calculation was that it would take 20,000 men of peak physical strength, enough to move the top layer. It would take them a coordinated effort over a period of years. They had heard from their parents, from their parents' parents, from great-grandparents and beggars of the desert, from mystics and scientists alike, from all of these people they had heard of the object. It had been part of their lives, always present, always demanding attention, evoking questions, providing no answers, nourishing only a mythology of speculation, else nothing. And so this became a society comforted and habituated into sacrifice. And with that in mind, the training began. Boys were taken from their parents and sent to camps. These desert nations were building armies of pushers and pullers, a massive human can opener. At these camp, technologies of leverage were iterated on, tested, systems by which to announce the push and pull across kilometers of desert were devised. Never before had they undertaken such a massive attempt at communication. Thousands of camps were deployed when the time was ready around the object, food supply chains established. It was determined that the pushing and pulling would take weeks, if not months, to get the lid of the object to a state of total verticality. Because of the volatility of the desert, the hot, the cold, the frost at night, the burning suns in the afternoon, which so weirdly characterized the Gobi, the moments would take place, the moments of movement would take place at dusk and dawn, timed precisely to the intervals of the moon rising or setting. During the hour in which the sky cycles into or out of nothingness, thousands of ropes were attached to the outer lid of the object, ropes kilometers and kilometers in length, the width of a man's thigh. They were draped across the burning animal skins, now beginning to fade from a dark to light brown because of the 100 years of exposure into the desert sun. Skins that screamed and screeched daily in the undulating temperatures of the Gobi. 10,000 men lined up on one side of the object, 2 kilometers away, another 10,000 lined up. Wedges ground out of the bones of massive animals now extinct, animals made extinct by the production of these tools, were in hand, scholars draped in saffron robes, slapping and snapping, debating, notebooks in hand, ready to peek inside. Everyone was prepared. The signals were sent. They were combinations of fugue-like iterations of song with specially understood points of phase overlap on which the pushing and pulling would happen. Under the first full moon of the 6th month of the year of the opening, of course, as it would be known, beneath billions of bits of cosmic information, the song rippled out across the deep blue of the night that is so characteristic of the open desert. The men on the side of the hinge pulled, the men on the side of the flap pushed, wedges were inserted, a creaking that was said to be heard as far as the plateau of Tibet was released from the object, a groan. That first night, they managed to move the top of the object almost a meter into the air before the men were passing out, exhausted, hands bleeding. They rested for a day, and then again, the songs rippled out. Ask children who were around at the time of this what it felt like, what the sound of that song rippling through the desert every evening was. For months, they moved the object centimeter by centimeter higher. A few times, they lost their grip. Men were crushed under the weight. After months, the top of the object reached peak verticality, and with one last heave, one last hoe, the hinge let out a massive sigh, this time in undisputable relief. As the lid, the cover, if you can imagine this vertical tower, 2 kilometers high, 5 kilometers long, teetered for a moment as the first morning light exploded from the east, casting a shadow hundreds of kilometers long, as this object then came crashing down on the other side of the desert. Nobody had anticipated the force with which the object would attack the desert floor. Millions of pounds of animal skin dried, smashed into the sands with such impact that all of the men on the side of the hinge who didn't make it to shelter died instantly. Still, it was open, and their lives weren't the first sacrifices to be made in unraveling this myth. Word spread quickly. Villages told travelers, told children, told elders. Revealed beneath that top skin were perfectly smooth sheets of pulp with huge black letters, the darkest ink anyone had ever seen. The marks were multitudinous. Billions upon billions. It wasn't until months later that someone on the peak of a mountain nearby realized just what they were, what they had unearthed, a fractal of information. The billions of tiny marks on each page, when viewed from afar, formed larger individual marks, stories embedded within stories, layers of pulp, each a page in a greater story, and each character on the page composed of 1,000 sub-stories. It took hundreds more years to get through the first few pages. Despite the best attempts at protecting the object, there were countless problems. Theft was, of course, rampant. Large swaths of the pulp were cut off in the dead of the night. Some folks revered the object, others loathed it, and many tried to destroy it with fire. It wasn't long before the governments realized the pulp was useful for a number of things, so they began to harvest it. The excesses of pages once categorized and filed away to the best of the ability of scholars was sliced into millions of pieces. These stories became currencies. People used it for barter. You could buy a basket of rice for a pound of story. The more black ink, the more valuable. At first, it was trade purely through nostalgia, the value of simply owning a piece of that core myth that had so defined these desert people for so long. The ethereality of that myth made finally tangible, culture folding into culture. But as uses for it grew, so did the value. Clothes were fashioned from the stories. They wore the promise of the myths of their great-grandparents to the market, to temples, to war, while tending their horses, shrouded in these myths, in this pulp, on long pilgrimage spanning decades. Ground in water and boiled, it made a fine earthy stew. Little children slept between the sheets of the stories, above and below these layers of myth that had haunted these people for so long. New traditions sprang up, new romanticisms. When babies were born, they got a piece of the pulp. And as they grew older and made new friends and new lovers and new enemies, they would check each other's pulp and see if they were adjacent. An infinitesimally small chance of rebuilding an impossible puzzle. Time passed, large pieces of the puzzle, of the pulp, of the object were lost in wars, and it took hundreds more years to understand the languages. But finally they were understood. And slowly the mythologies of the stories were united with the actual stories within that object itself. They were reproduced, commoditized, through the age of mechanical reproduction. All nostalgic quality of the stories was lost. The myths of the myths were produced alongside the actual myths. People forgot which were the originals and which were invented. They became further atomized. The objects were called books. The age of mechanical reproduction gave way to the age of photographic reproduction. Walter Benjamin did a somersault. And the books were reproduced once more, made small, nearly invisible, such so that almost all of them would fit atop a reasonably sized desk. They were getting closer to a nothingness. At first glance, these microscopic books, photographed and atop a table, were more similar than ever to that idea of this embedded object in the desert so long ago. But this atomization process that happened, while making them untouchable to us, the physicality of them now lost once again, had compressed them into a single-dimensional point in the eyes of our tools. And in this compression into a point, in this the book is no longer a package. It's information service. And of course, this was said in 1967, and it was said by Marshall McLuhan. And what happened in the 40 years following this has been just a formalization of this atomization, an attempt to agree on and codify what that single point into which all content and books are being smushed. It seems as if we are now, once again, on the edge of something buried in a desert. There's the myth of what that object might be. There's dissemination within our culture of that myth. We heard it today in the iPhones and the Kindles and the iPads that we all carry. We are presently building tools to excavate this object, to excavate the promise that's locked within these tools, within these devices. But we've yet to find the right ones. The difference now is that the object or objects we're pulling out are no longer just the stories themselves like they were so long ago. There are interactions with these stories. Each time a machine watches us flip a page, it's recorded. What we're building now is a new mapping for an object of which we don't yet know the size, of which doesn't have a determinate size, of which changes as we change, as we touch it, of which we can't ever really fathom. And for this, we're imagining containers as designers. We're working together to give form to this ethereality. And it's frustrating and scary at times, but I think I speak for all of us who are here working on this problem, that there is a pervasive and great joy and gratitude to be here now at this point of convergence where we are searching for the shape of the future book. Thank you.